Saving money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. We have a huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes, from setting a post or pouring a walkway to installing concrete block or natural stone. We've got the mix you need in stock today. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Paul Fisher, who's got a new book out, The Last Kings of Hollywood, Coppola, Lucas, Spielberg, and The Battle for the Soul of American Cinema. It's a really fun book if you're into this period of cinematic history. And I feel like everyone my age, our age, really is. Paul, thanks for being on the show today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Sonny. Thanks for the kind words about the book, too.
I feel like this is an endlessly fascinating period because there's a paradox really at the heart of this story, which is, on the one hand, you have three of the greatest, like objectively, just three of the greatest filmmakers of all time. You have Spielberg, Lucas, Coppola, you know, the movies they have made in this period in particular, we're talking about the 1970s here, beginning of the 1980s, are all-time classics. Very few people would deny it, and you can quibble over, you know, 1941 is that, whatever. But these are great movies, and also the movies that may have destroyed movies, right. which is a real pickle to work through.
It is, yeah. It's one of the things that fascinated me about the book, about the period originally, is, you know, obviously it's been written about a lot, and there's generally this idea that the 70s were kind of this sex, drugs, and rock and roll filmmaker generation, the kind of lunatics, the COVID asylum. They had their fun. They made masterpieces for a decade or so. And then, you know, you get Heaven's Gate and you get Apocalypse Now, and then the grown-up suits have to come back in and rein everybody in and kind of fine-tune what they did into a system. And what I found kind of interesting was that these guys, when they were young, especially Coppola, especially Lucas, they kind of had... they weren't lunatics running the asylum. They had a sense of exactly what would happen, of there's new technology now we can harness. We can make films our own way. We can make films for our generation that are accessible to everybody. You know, Lucas very early was talking about computer-generated filmmaking and not having to sort of almost, he would think of it as compromise, but collaborate with people he didn't want to. And so from the very start, they had this feeling of all the positives and all the negatives. You know, we're going to rescue this dying industry by making these great, entertaining, but also very worthwhile films that appeal to a wide mainstream and a good play in the cinema and everything. And also from the very start, had this desire, not just knowledge and prediction of, but this desire for filmmaking that would eventually kind of bring doors down on other people trying to do the same thing. And that would kind of contribute to monoculture. And they knew it to some degree. And that was kind of the interesting human paradox of it. And you know, in a kind of Greek tragedy kind of way, that from the start, your kind of faith is seated in the things that you want. And that was the case for these guys.
So let's go back to you, your formulation of this book. Why these three? Why Coppola and Lucas and Spielberg? Because I mean, look, you've also got Scorsese in this time. In the book, you talk to Brian De Palma, who has a bunch of hits around this time. Why these three?
Well, I narrowed it down, right? So it started with this idea of, you know, I went to film school. I know people went to art school. Everybody goes to film school, art school. At some point, you have that moment with your mates where you're kind of like, oh, you know what we should do? We should get a barn and we should like do our own thing and we'll make masterpieces without having to worry about all the idiots in the industry. And so that kind of started from realizing, oh, wait, George Lucas and Francis Coppola did that thing. They left film school and they got a warehouse and they were saying all these same things. And then they did it. They did the thing. So it started with them, and then tracking that kind of time period, you go, okay, well, Spielberg's kind of an interesting counterpoint in the sense that he was in film school, kind of making his own film program in Long Beach. And he wanted the opposite. You know, he was like, no, I want to work in a studio system. I want to be a system guy. I don't want to revolutionize the system. I just want a place in the system. And there was a narrative arc to the three of them, in the sense that, to kind of simplify, George and Francis are a pair in the late 60s. And then as time evolves 15 years later, George and Steven are a pair. And they represent something that Coppola has been kind of left out of, even though he kind of led the whole way with the thing. And so that kind of set the template for, okay, these are the three guys, they'll be kind of the fulcrum for this period that you're looking at, and you can use everybody else in the same way. And then once that was established, there's a way, narratively, quote unquote, but in terms of focus, where the other guys kind of recede, right? Like, Scorsese is maybe the one personally and on a filmmaking level that I find the most interesting. But sort of deliberately, even at the time, he was an outsider to that kind of dynamic. You know, he just wanted to make films. He wanted to be in New York, that kind of thing. De Palma, by his own confession, you know, he, Schrader, Milius, those guys, they never had those hits, right? Like, the thing that connects Coppola, Lucas, and Spielberg, that's kind of crazy. And like, imagine yourself and two of your best buddies, and one of you goes and makes The Godfather and it's the biggest film ever, and one of you goes and makes Jaws and that becomes the biggest film ever, and then the other one makes Star Wars and that becomes even bigger than the other two, and then the one who made Jaws makes E.T. and that becomes even bigger. And it's just like, okay, these guys are at a level that the other ones aren't. And so it kind of made sense to use the three of them, as this will be the focal point and the kind of spectrum through which everybody can move, and we can see what kind of happened in this 15 years.
So let's talk about what happened, because I mean, Coppola starts this film company, American Zoetrope, as you say, you know, it's not a barn. It's a nice building in San Francisco. But the idea here is the same. Hey, we're going to do this thing. We're going to do it different, and we're going to knock all their socks off. And it just never quite gels.
It never did. And it's very relatable to today, in the sense that one of the things that drove Coppola at that point was, hey, the Germans are making editing flatbeds. We can edit ourselves. We don't need to go into the studio. The French are using small cameras. We can film stuff ourselves. We don't need to go into the back lot. And so it's driven by this thing now that, you know, if kids are going, oh, I got Final Cut on my computer, I got a camera, I can make special effects, I can do stuff at home, you know, I can do low budget horror films with my friends, whatever. It was driven by the same kind of belief in technology and collaboration. And that was sound. But then what comes into it is ego to some degree, where you have some very talented people like him and Lucas who are all going, yeah, we're all equals, but I do sort of expect to be more equal than everybody else. Mm-hmm. And then you also get this rush, and this is a feeling they seem to be aware of at the time, of our opportunity is here, but it's going to be gone really quickly, so we got to take advantage as quickly as possible. And that got messy. And so essentially what happened with Zoetrope is, you know, Coppola by the late 60s was already a very well-paid staff writer at Warner Brothers. And he basically wrangled, you know, 300 grand out of the studio brass to say, look, I know all the young kids coming up. We'll have a company. We'll make a bunch of films for the youth market. You know, almost Roger Corman, but highbrow. You know, we'll make documentaries and we'll make dramas and sci-fi films and this kind of thing. And Warner Brothers, for your 300 grand, you get kind of dibs on a whole generation of kids. That was kind of his pitch. And then the kids come into the warehouse and they act like kids, right? They all kind of follow their compulsions and impulses, and they don't have the experience. And so they only really, in that first instance, made one film, really, which was THX 1138, which everybody hates. And Francis is overspent on espresso machines and parties and that kind of thing. And almost like a startup up in the Bay that, you know, people raise money for too quickly, didn't really know what they were doing. It kind of pops really quickly.
Well, it almost feels like, you know, these ridiculous influencer houses, right? It feels like, you know, we've got all these Instagram kids. We're going to put them together and they're going to, you know, make content that people will, you know, watch on their phones. But as you say, highbrow.
Yeah. And honestly, it's exactly like that. And you get people like Lucas and like John Cordy, who was a very well-respected filmmaker at the time in the Bay Area, who very quickly were like, I can't work in this place. I'm, you know, Lucas was like, I'm working from home. Cordy was like, I'm going back to my literal barn. because it was very much like that. You speak to people who are like, you know, you'd walk into this building on Folsom Street, go upstairs, and there's, you know, Francis patting a girl's butt, and there's people playing pool and smoking weed. And it's 1969, right? So people are going, no, that's what we need for our process. But it kind of died very, very quickly. And this whole wonderful plan for what would be the kind of whole future of the industry. And that's another thing that's interesting about the book, is they succeed in going, we're going to get the warehouse, the barn, and do our own thing. But at first, they fail really, really badly. And Coppola's entire career for the next 15, 20 years, all the hits, everything, is kind of driven by this thing that he's in his 30s with two kids and a third on the way. And he's done the whole, we're going to, you know, he's gambled his screenwriting income onto, I'm going to be independent and a big shot. And he's actually in giant debt. And every penny he's going to make for a while is going right back to Warner Brothers to pay back this thing. Which makes for, you know, a really, really compelling human drama, but B, also this like crossroads of film history. Cause then you get The Godfather, which Coppola only takes cause he's got to pay the bills, cause he hates the idea of this book and he doesn't want to make the film, but he's got bills to pay. Which is another thing I find interesting about it, these guys, is that as much as they were great at predicting the future of the industry and as much as they were confident about themselves, they were also young guys with like a tremendous lack of self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And a lot of their, you know, I speak to people and go, you know, what makes these guys geniuses? What's the difference? And you get different answers. But one of the really interesting things was a lot of the stuff that worked out for them was sort of against their will and against their better instinct. So they were dragged kicking and screaming into it. And Godfather was one of those. And it's a film Coppola kind of originally only made because he had to keep the bailiffs from taking his stuff.
Yeah, it is. It's fascinating to, again, look at this period of history and look at these filmmakers and think about the way in which cinema has always been this kind of confluence of art and commerce, right? Like, movies are expensive to make. Like, bottom line, cost millions and millions of dollars to make a movie. It's not cheap. And as such, you know, at a certain point, you do have to like make things that make money. And the two who have, you know, kind of most fervently embraced that were Spielberg and Lucas, right. And they are both billionaires. I mean, literal billionaires. And Coppola, meanwhile, is doing a traveling tour, trying to get somebody to pick up the rights to Megalopolis on Blu-ray. You know, like it really is fascinating. But like, and I don't the inherent tension here is, I would put Coppola's 1970s run of Godfather, The Conversation, Godfather Part Two, Apocalypse Now, and also Patton, which he wrote. Like, people forget he won an Oscar for writing Patton, up against anything that the others have made. I mean, you know, Spielberg's great, Lucas a little more limited in terms of what he's made, but like those are five foundational films in cinema history. And yet he is the one who is kind of on the outside looking in terms of the financial success of it all.
Yeah. He's, you know, writing the book, you realize, oh, the Conversation and Godfather 2 came out the same year. You know, the Oscars that year, you almost read the nominations and it's like Coppola against Coppola against Coppola against Coppola. And he's producing them and writing them and directing them. And there's a variety in those films. And I think part of that, I think, is Coppola. Part of that is his sense of, you almost feel there that there's someone who's not just satisfied with that one thing, with the filmmaking. So you get a sense of a guy who, you know, a couple of people are like, you know, Francis would have loved to be a novelist. And a couple of people say, oh, you know, Francis would have loved, you know, just wants to be an artist. And so I think to some dimension, you know, Spielberg, everybody will tell you from a young age, interested in everything about filmmaking, from the numbers to the brass tacks to the popcorn to everything. Lucas, very business-minded, knows his numbers, rational, whatever. And Coppola kind of wanted to be Balzac, you know, just kind of drinking coffee and sleeping with girls and pouring out a prodigious amount of work. Some of which would be masterpieces and some of which would get forgotten, and drinking espresso and And so it's almost by personality and intent. But then there's also this dimension which comes to play in this, and which comes to play today for filmmakers, which is films are really expensive to make and almost more expensive to distribute, you know, to find your audience. And so Spielberg benefited in a great way from, I'm working in the system, so there's an infrastructure for my films. And, you know, in a very nerdy way, Jaws becomes as big as it becomes because it's first studio that for the first time goes, hey, we're not going to do five cinemas in New York, five cinemas in LA, and then take it big. We're just going to put in hundreds of cinemas across the country, blast ads on TV, and make people feel you've got to see this tomorrow. Got to happen tomorrow. If you're not, if you haven't seen it by Saturday morning, you've missed out. Mm-hmm. So he benefits from that. And then Lucas also had an understanding of that, because the kind of founding of his money, of his fortune, is he decided, I'm going to make this thing, the Star Wars thing. I'm going to control the movie. I'm going to own the movie. The studio won't own the movie. I'm going to own the special effects house. I'm going to own the toys, everything about it. And I kind of just need the studio to get me into cinemas. And Coppola was different. Coppola would go, no, I'll get the studio. I'll make the films. I'll own the films. And then they'll be so great, everybody's going to come in and want to distribute them. And obviously that doesn't work, because, you know, you don't hit a home run every time you're on the plate.
Yeah. And again, I hate to keep going back to Megalopolis, but it is just this fascinating thing where he couldn't find anybody to distribute it, but he couldn't find anybody to distribute it because he wanted to own it forever. Yeah. Right? Like, why would Lionsgate put money into distributing it, you know, if they're not going to own a piece of it? They did end up distributing it, but, you know, it was kind of, it was a hard sell. And I think, you know, folks didn't show up. All right. So you, back to your book, you talked to a bunch of people who were there at Zoetrope at the time. The most interesting, I did not know this until reading this, was Rebecca De Mornay. Okay. Who was, what was she doing at Zoetrope? It's a fascinating little tidbit.
Well, one of the things that Coppola wanted to try at Zoetrope Studios, which was the LA version of the company in the early 80s, is he launched a company with a film called One from the Heart, which is a very theatrical kind of film. And Coppola had this idea that he would not just own the studio, own the films, and have a slate of films, but that he would have a troupe of actors, as in theater. So Rebecca De Mornay was a, you know, acting student in town, and like many other people, she came out of acting class one day, and there was a ad pinned on the board, you know, Zoetrope is looking for interesting people, or, you know, actors, whatever. And so what she became was a stand-in for a film, which is not a thing, you know, for people who don't really know the process. You know, you get stand-ins in film for lighting and stuff, but you don't get understudies in that sense. Mm-hmm. And De Mornay was kind of a group of understudies for One from the Heart, because Coppola, again, with this faith in technology and process, had this idea of, oh, I can put all my editing gear and my monitors and stuff into a VW van that they call the Silverfish. And I can direct from here and I can see the takes. But to save money, basically he invented pre-viz for live action films. I'm going to rehearse these everything with my cheap understudies, block it, everything. And then I'll bring in Terry Garr and Raul Julia and whoever and show them the rehearsal on the tape and be like, all right, now you just do the pre-viz and we'll do it. And so Rebecca De Mornay was one of a group of people who were understudies, and, you know, which essentially meant rehearsing the film for people, getting told off by the actors who were like, no, I can do my own job, thank you very much. Yeah. And then bouncing around the back lot, making short films with Coppola's kids, really. And that was Coppola, you know, and that's kind of also why this stuff fails and doesn't fail, is like, the line's very thin, right? Like, the reason he would insist on owning Megalopolis is he insisted on owning Apocalypse Now. And that's literally what's paid the bills and bought him the winery kind of thing. So if that works out and you own the film over 20, 30, 40, 50 years, it pays out. If it doesn't work out, then the film's a dud and you're just owning something that's a meaningless asset. you know, you're touring with basically a $200 million student film no one wants to see. And I think Coppola, he's kind of like that filmmaker's filmmaker, I think, in the sense that you get a lot of filmmakers who have that great final film they've never made because mm-hmm. they were going around hat in hand. And he's the guy who, like, you know, put his money where his mouth is and actually sell everything and make the big final film, even if it's crap. even if no one likes it. And even if people are like, this is crap, we don't want to see it. They're like, I'll just book it in cinemas and tour with it like I'm a carny. You know, and who, if people will say, you got to be able to do anything for a film, but they don't really mean that because they still want the first class ticket and the paycheck and the, you know, whereas he's the guy who's like, oh, I'll do anything for the paycheck. I'll sell everything. And try and do weird stuff he doesn't need to do in the process, like having understudies for a movie.
Save big money on your next painting project at Menards. Pristine interior paint and primer in one is Dutch Boy's best hiding and most durable paint. It delivers a smooth, elegant finish while providing maximum scuff, stain, and mark resistance. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and get your painting project started today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
Yeah. What do what did the filmmakers you talked to in this film, what was their take on this period and how these guys acted and behaved and, you know, what they made? Because, you know, you talked to like you said, you talked to Brian De Palma in this book. You talked to Walter Murch, some other what was their read on this period and the result of it?
Well, they're sort of adjacent in the sense that, you know, Murch, who's a very cerebral kind of guy, he's got this almost fatalistic, clear-eyed thing of, you know, we talked and he gave me this big talk about the lifespan of cells and stuff. He's very smart, Walter. And he was like, you know, everybody's got 10 years. You know, athletes, skin cells, filmmakers, basically got 10 years at the top and then it flips to somebody else. And every revolution becomes co-opted and becomes a system. And so that's what happened to us. And there you go. Paul Schrader, you know, told me roughly the same thing, except it was kind of couched more in the terms of like, we did great, it was great, and then, you know, the effing suits came in and there was Reagan and they kind of took everything away from us and the house always wins kind of thing. I think the overriding feeling from all of them, because another, you know, because I see parallels right between then and now where you kind of think, okay, these were young guys. And they were working in a country where there was, you know, no one really trusted the politicians. Corporations were kind of getting bigger and bigger. The film industry was dying. They felt like there were no jobs for anybody. There's protests in the streets. There's new technology no one really knows how to use. That sounds very similar to today. And then I'd speak to a lot of them and they'd go, nah, it's not similar in any way. And it really came down to two things in the sense that they would all say, well, number one, back then you could, as De Palma said, you know, you could be Final Cut directors. You could control your film and you could decide what it was. And then it went to the cinema and if it failed, it failed. And that was on you. But you could get to that point and you can't do that anymore if you want to work in the system. And then Schrader had this great kind of pithy line of kind of like back then, not everybody could make a film, but everybody got paid if they did. And today everybody can make a film and no one gets paid when they do. Mm-hmm. So the kind of livelihood aspect of it has just flipped on its head. And so I think they all have a sense even now of, you know, there's a breach in the curtain and we all rushed in and it was a great period where no one knew what they were doing. And so they trusted us kids to try stuff. And we had the power to finish the stuff we were trying and they paid us to do it. You know, you could pay the bills while you did it. It wasn't all on spec basically. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, you know, the system caught up, the execs caught up, that kind of thing. And obviously, and I always try and asterisk it with this, these are all, for the most part, fairly middle-class white dudes, right? So there are plenty of female filmmakers, filmmakers of colors, of color, who throughout the whole period, you know, they didn't get to run through the gap in the curtain. You know, they all kind of had to stay in their niches, no matter how well the films did or how well received they were. But I think these guys, however they put it, whatever the vocabulary is, they're conscious that kind of this was the period where we got to do stuff with integrity that people would see that we would get paid to do that has not been replicated.
I want to hop to something you just said that people would see. Because we, you know, we're talking a lot about the filmmakers, we're talking a lot about the technology, we're talking a lot about the studios. But the audience has changed in terms of what they are willing to see, what they want to see, what they'll see in a theater versus see at home, you know, on streaming or whatever. The audience has changed. Did these, when they were looking back at this era, did they have any sense of that? Was there any discussion about what audiences would show up to in 1970 that they might not? I could, if you released The Conversation today, you released the exact same movie today, it would die horribly at the box office. I mean, it just would. It's not, that's not the sort of thing that people go see anymore. And I think that
it would
that,
at best be like an A24 kind of cult at, thing. Mini hit.
At best. You know, if you make it for about $5 million and you put it in New York and LA and it gets to about 12 overall, you're doing well. But I mean the audience is just not there anymore. And that is as big a shift as anything else that has happened over the last 50 years.
It's massive. And for a lot of them, you know, it's kind of looking back thinking, it's a shame it's not the way it used to be. And for some of them, there's a sense of, oh, well, it's the studios, you know, the studios rushed into streaming, or the studios aren't backing films anymore. Lucas, as early as the mid-70s, predicted it. There's interviews from him, kind of early writing Star Wars, where he says he had become kind of infatuated with the computers and what they could do. And like many people back then, kind of pre-internet, had this awareness of there will be this connected network of systems at some point. And so he gives these interviews even back then where he says, very positively and optimistically and hopefully, there will be a time very, very soon where the audience is all going to be niches. So if you like THX 1138, you can find it. You know, there's a metaphor he used later about sucking content through a straw. So basically you can find it in that straw. And if you like beach pictures, you can find it over there. And even before we had that kind of heavy monoculture of the 80s and 90s, he kind of predicted the thing that would come after, which is what we have now, right? You know, I've got friends who are massive horror fans. They subscribe to Shudder. They watch all that stuff. They love films I've never heard of. You know, my wife kind of prepares and expects TV shows on Netflix or whatever that I have no idea are coming out. I'm expecting stuff that she has no idea is coming out. Everybody can kind of pick their stuff. And so it's not anymore, you know, The Godfather comes out and it's a violent film, quite grown-up themes. And genuinely the feeling is everybody went to see it. Everybody talked about it. Everybody wrote about it. And that's never going to happen anymore, you know, unless it's, or even then, Avengers Doomsday. My wife isn't going to see that, but that's the only thing like that we have. And the bit that they didn't predict, I don't think, was this idea of, you know, the Godfather was so big, Jaws was so big, Star Wars was so big, E.T. was so big. And as it went, the bigness was A, predicated on young people, and it was predicated on a different model from before, in the sense that, and this is a bit nerdy, but up to Jaws, the idea was you release your film in a few theaters on the coast, and it gets good reviews, and then you go big. And then after Jaws, the idea was you release your film big, and people come and see it. And then you see if it has legs. And so the model used to be word of mouth, and then the model became hype. And so over time, no matter how great the film is, doesn't matter, because you got to build in the hype before people even see it. And so the model became predicated around the films that are going to go big, the films that lots of people are going to go see, need to be kind of lowest common denominator, because they can't be about like, hey, Sonny, I saw this film on Tuesday. It's called The Conversation. It's amazing. You should go see it. It's built on, we've all heard of it on Wednesday, and we're going to go see it on the weekend because it's the one thing we're aware of. And there can't be 200 things we've all heard of that we're all going to go see opening weekend. So then everything else falls down a bit into its own niches. And that's a shame. And, it's something that we crave. Anytime something happens that's, you know, K-pop Demon Hunters for the kids or Heated Rivalry or stuff that we can talk about and share collectively, kind of across demographics, we're all getting a hit of what it used to be every week, basically.
Yeah, it's funny because you in the book, forgive me if I'm extrapolating or incorrect here, but I get the sense that you when you use the term monoculture, it is not a an approving way. Like, I feel like, you know, when you talk about the monoculture, I think a lot of people think this, right, that it's kind of stultifying, that it, you know, kind right. of it takes over everything and it limits what can be out there. But I do think we do have some nostalgia for that period of like, hey, this is a time when we were all sitting around talking about the same thing. And we miss this. We miss this kind of unifying cultural moment. And again, there is a real paradox here where, like, right now you have more options than ever before. You have more niches than ever before. Anybody can see anything they want. And yet nobody is talking about any of it because there's too much to talk about. I don't know how we live in this world. How do we navigate this existence? You know, it's a real problem. There is almost too much choice. And that is that, but that's insane because you can't really have too much choice, right? I don't know.
No, but it's also, it's white noise, right? Like, I came out of film school 20 years ago when we were still all kind of like hopeful about DV cameras and the internet and Sundance and this and that. And I have friends who make great films that no one's going to see, you know, that not just no one's going to see, but the lifespan is so short. You know, you maybe, if you are going to be in that niche that pays attention to it, you've got a week or so where people are paying attention. And then something else is out, and something else is out, and something else is out. And so there's a degree of, and it is more stale. You know, it's not like our culture feels richer, because we're all still having one dish, but it's just one niche dish that we're having, and then we're all living in comic book world as a kind of backdrop. But there's a paradox to it, as there's a paradox to everything, in the sense that, you know, we don't have curators really anymore. And that's part of the tentpole thing that these guys unwittingly created, is that for better or for worse, you know, elitist, privileged, only certain people got opportunities, whatever. The film system used to kind of have a balance between money making and a sense of curation. You know, Louis B. Mayer, I'm going way back, even if his taste was crap, he had taste, right? There's stuff he wanted to make and not make, and there's stuff he thought was useful and not useful. And Jaws and Star Wars and those things, the success became so big that curation kind of got completely blown out of it. And so now we do have all these niches, but they are driven primarily and sometimes only by, the only way we can pay for this is to grab people's attention span in the 5 minutes that we can to make some money. And it has flattened everything, right? And like the monoculture thing, I grew up in France. French people, obviously not big fans of monoculture and American culture and all that stuff. But in the 90s, there is something very cool about, oh, I'm a little sort of half Arabic kid growing up in France, and the people I've got on my wall are Steven Spielberg and Michael Jordan. And everybody I talk to will get what those things are. And, you know, my friends and we'll all go see Jurassic Park, and we have a kind of cultural common denominator. And that is part of the story of the 15 years in the book, is that every time you gain something, you lose something. And a lot of the stuff that these guys push forwards is also held back by stuff that kind of monkey pawed out of it. You know, I'll tell people now, like, we all live, unfortunately, in the world that these guys created, which is, you know, tentpoles for teenage boys and franchises, and everybody wants to own Star Wars and that kind of thing. But we also fortunately live in the world that these guys created, which is where, you know, people went, no, I'm going to be independent and I'm going to do my own thing and I'm going to own my films. And they made massive films and it worked out for them. And they kind of set an example and a path for, okay, if you want to do that, there is a way to do that. And that didn't exist before them. You know, the context of before them was filmmakers were employees. You know, you worked for Warner Brothers and you made what they told you to do, and you did that for 20 years until they decided to cut you or something, and you worked your way up from being an AD. And so, you know, writing a book, and again, narratively, weird term, that's what makes stuff interesting. We're like, oh, I like this and I hate this. you know, it worked out than it didn't. Yeah. The kind of failure is in the success.
Yeah. Like I say, it's really paradox. That's the word I keep coming back to. All right. One last question about the book here, before we get to the exit question. What was the biggest surprise for you? What did you learn while you were reporting this out that you not only did not know, but did not expect to know?
There are a few things
you were writing.
I got really lucky near the end. Marty Scorsese's first wife, Lorraine Brennan, she's never given an interview to anybody before we spoke for this book, which I was very grateful for. And there's a period about Scorsese between kind of NYU and Roger Corman that people kind of gloss over generally. And there's stuff we talked about, you know, with Lorraine, his ex-wife, about this version of Martin Scorsese, who's this young, very driven, very ambitious guy, who again, it has sort of failed in the sense that people worry about failing, in the sense that he's living in Jersey, he's got a wife and baby, he's working for TV, no one wants to make his films. You know, he's in his 20s and he's done already, kind of thing, he's cooked. And then success kind of knocks at his door and he has this crossroads of, I either do the more moral thing of staying in Jersey with my wife and kid and seeing what works out, or I follow the ambition and the temptation and I leave all of that at a time that's awful and inconvenient for everybody. But I sort of know in my gut I have to do for myself in an act of, you know, almost like self-life-saving selfishness kind of thing. So that whole period and that whole drive and that whole relationship, that kind of recast my image of Martin Scorsese in a way that I found really interesting, and not in a way that's kind of like, oh, horrible person, did a horrible thing, but more, okay, I can see a lot of the stuff in the films about the kind of debate between trying to be a good person and being a base selfish person, and this kind of very original career sin kind of thing. So it's not about the three main guys, but it takes some space in the book, and I enjoyed kind of digging into that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if you think there's anything folks should know about your book or the world of filmmaking in general, the world, whatever. What did we not discuss that we should have?
I don't know. That's too good a question. No. It was a really interesting chat. I think the thing I like about the book, you know, there's the thing I'm proud of with the book, I think, is I did try very hard for it not to be about these mythic figures that, you know, their last names have become brands almost, you know, and I call them by their first names in the book to kind of create some intimacy. And kind of hopefully the book is more about, or works more on a level that it's about these guys as people, than it is just about filmmakers and the ins and outs of it. But hopefully you can read bits of the book and you're like, oh yeah, I know a guy like that and I understand that impulse and I've been that impulse. And hopefully it works on that level. I can't think of any other question.
Okay. No, it's good. I like to, I've done my job then. All right. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Again, the name of the book is Last Kings of Hollywood, Coppola, Lucas, Spielberg, and the Battle for the Soul of American Cinema. Paul, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and we'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.